Hello. Before we get into this week's episode, I want to tell you all about an exciting event that we have coming up. David Starkey will be joining Brendan O'Neill for a special live recording of Brendan's podcast on Tuesday, the 14th of December. David and Brendan will be live on Zoom talking about the history wars, green hysteria, the tyranny of woke, and much more. Spike supporters can get in for free, so if you are a Spike supporter, you can claim your ticket now from the supporters hub. And if you're not yet a Spike supporter, then why not sign up today? You'll get free access to this event, plus lots of other exciting perks. Tickets will go on general sale next week if there are any spaces remaining, but supporters get first dibs. So become a Spike supporter now if you want to make sure you get your ticket. Just sign up now at spiked-online.com/supporters. That's spiked-online.com/supporters. See you there. Welcome to Last Orders, a look at the news each month from a slightly disgruntled, libertarian-ish perspective. In this episode, we discuss the Omicron variant, why America is tearing itself apart, and the genius of Barry Humphries. Hello and welcome to Last Orders. I'm Tom Slater, editor of Spiked. I'm joined today, as I am every month, by Chris Snowden from the Institute of Economic Affairs. Say hello, Chris.
Hello, Chris.
Brilliant. And we're joined by another comedian today, and that's Simon Evans, who's a fantastic stand-up, a writer, and I'm very pleased to say a recently minted Spiked columnist as well. So, Simon, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
I don't know about minted on the Spiked face, but yes, thank you.
I'll have a word with the accounts people. So we're going to talk about a bunch of things today, but let's start off with the big story which is dominating everything, which of course is the Labour the Omicron variant, the new variant, which was discovered in South Africa at first, has since apparently got all around the world. Various governments responding to this. In the UK, we're recording this on Tuesday, the mask mandate for shops and transport has come back in, new rules around self-isolation, so even if you're vaccinated, you've got to isolate for 10 days, more travel restrictions, light though they are, for all international travel. But there's still a lot of open questions, Chris, I think it's fair to say, about how deadly this particular strain is. It seems like we know that it's more transmissible, but whether or not it's actually going to trouble the hospitals is still an open question. So do you think that the government has overreacted over scant information, or do you think that it pays to be cautious at this point?
I think in a way, I mean, we don't know what's going to be said in this bloody briefing yet, do we? But at the moment, if it just stays at being masks in shops and on public transport, I would say that politically, he's probably done the absolute least he could do, really. I'm not in favour of it. I don't think he should do it. And these things are actually much more damaging both psychologically and economically than a lot of people give him credit for. But given the pressure that he's under and given what other countries are doing, I think he probably did the absolute minimum, and I hope he doesn't do any more. We don't know anything about it. I'm a bit puzzled that scientists are saying it's going to be 2 months before we do really know anything about it. I mean, supposedly there's masses of people in South Africa who've got it. Can't we monitor them for a few weeks? And, you know, if they're suddenly dropping dead or at least going into hospital in large numbers, then we know we've got trouble on our hands. You say that we know it's more transmissible. It probably is based on its, you know, its structure, but we don't actually know that in terms of real world evidence yet.
Sort of speculation based on the area around Johannesburg or something like this.
It's shot up in that area, but from a very low base. You know, it shot up last summer, it shot up last winter, it shot up a lot of times in South Africa. They've had a very, very bad time of it. So no, we don't know very much about it. I wouldn't say we don't know anything about it, because you can infer a lot of things from the number of mutations. And by God, it has mutated to a ridiculous degree, as far as I can tell. Seems to have gone through some HIV patient. So, you know, it doesn't sound good that the whole world's now threatened with sort of African COVID AIDS. But
it's a very delicate way of putting it.
We have to, you know, if we can weather this storm, we can weather any of them, I would say, because, you know, I'm not a virologist, as I often say on this podcast, but because I know people do mistake me for one. But it looks like about as bad as a mutation as you can get. And the very, very early evidence from the doctors in South Africa is actually hardly any one of these people are going to hospital. The unvaccinated are having it quite badly, but the people who have been vaccinated have had it remarkably mildly. So, you know, all what you can do, touch wood. But let's not start ruining anything or bringing up any restrictions. There's not anything really we can do. Let's say it's masses more transmissible and much more deadly. What are we actually going to do? Are we going to go into lockdown again? for how long? It's going to take months and months before they get a vaccine that's going to deal with this. And then obviously another 6 months minimum before they start injecting people. We're not going to go through this again. So, I mean, it seems to me either way, we shouldn't do very much about it, because if it turns out to be not a big problem, then obviously we shouldn't do anything about it. If it turns out to be a really big problem, then I just think, well, we tried our best. It's game over. I'm afraid we're just going to have to let it spread this time. The reality is somewhere in between, which it could well, it probably is going to be a bit worse, maybe even significantly worse than Delta. And that it's going to, you know, it's inconvenient that it's coming up around Christmas time, of course, particularly if it's much more transmissible. But we've done a great job with the booster shots. And if three or four shots don't significantly help, it would be extremely surprising. And the sensible scientists that I kind of follow seem to be saying, look, we need to calm down a bit about this. South Africa is very thinly vaccinated. We're very, very heavily vaccinated. Plus, we've got masses of natural immunity, thanks to the government's masterful strategy of infecting everyone with COVID.
So, Simon, one question that's come up this week is, will people put up with any more of this? You know, the mask mandate thing is slightly more trivial in the grand scheme of things, I guess. But if there were more restrictions, so Chris Whitty was quoted this week as saying that's the thing that keeps him up at night, is that if more measures had to be taken, that people are just so fatigued that they wouldn't necessarily go along with it. Do you think that's the case? Do you think people are done with this pandemic, or are they still so kind of frightened by what might happen that they'd even go along with things?
Well, I have a great track record of anticipating what the British people will be like and how they'll respond. I thought that they would roar like the lions of yore when told to stay in their houses, and in fact they trooped in like very much tame house cats. So I stand ready to be disappointed by their determination to defend their liberty at all costs once again. I do find the term mask mandate just absurdly, it's just immediately conjures up the Lone Ranger, doesn't it? The mask man bit of that. So you need a new term that is immediately risible. But the I don't know why it's a mandate. I think it seems to be a suggestion. I went onto the tube this morning. About half the people weren't wearing masks. I did wear mine in a very desultory kind of, I'm not really wearing this kind of way.
There was a fellow stopped me
as I went into TK Maxx and demanded I put my mask on, and he wasn't wearing one. I said, you're not wearing any. He went, I've got dispensation, and pointed to his badge. And I did say, you know, I think TK Maxx maybe ought to look at who's performing which role in this store. It's going to put somebody on the door that's demanding you wear a mask. It'd probably best if they were actually capable of obeying that. Well, I don't know. I mean, I agree with what Chris has said about we don't know. The things that I have heard seem to suggest that it is more transmissible, that there does seem to be enough anecdotal evidence that that is the case for me to believe it. And some people say really quite several times more transmissible. But normally, as viruses develop, I mean, this is fairly, we all knew this before the pandemic, right? As viruses develop, they try and become more transmissible and less deadly. That's their usual MO. You know, obviously, we're talking about a non-sentient being. We're talking about natural selection, but the more transmissible it is, the more easily airborne it is. For instance, the fear always with HIV was that it would become airborne at some point. You know, it would become a thing you could infect people with coughs and sneezes, but it would be much less likely to kill you as a result. They get less heavy and so on. This is a significant mutation, but that is not anything that doesn't remotely correlate with and therefore is more deadly. It might correlate with and therefore we'll be able to, you know, sell a dummy to the vaccine, but it doesn't mean that once it gets in you, it's going to hospitalize you for a fortnight. It might be that's the sacrifice it's made. It's decided to go for the, you know, the quick kidney punch and out, you know. And I have heard people saying even the unvaccinated have gone into hospital with this, have had maybe 3 or 4 days feeling a bit heavy, like there's an elephant on your chest, and then back out again, you know. And I mean, I think probably most people would take that as against 6 months of lockdown, you know. So, yeah, everything that Chris said, essentially. The one person I do find quite interesting on these things is Scott Alexander, as he is on most things. I don't know if you follow his Slate Star Codex blog. And he did a sort of meta-analysis of where the betting is at the moment, which is always quite a good way of understanding what's really likely to be happening. And it was much less than evens that this is going to be any worse, basically.
Can you bet on these things? I've been looking at whether
people are, they don't bet on whether it's going to, it's not like a Deadpool. They bet on things like, you know, the stock market and things like, you know, what's going to react, you know, stores, hospitality, places that would suffer immediately if there was lockdown. And the general feeling seems to be quite buoyant. So I'm inclined to, but I mean, you know, it's largely a question of mood, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, and I feel at the moment I've got the wind at my back. I've had a good 3 months and this is not going to knock me off my rails. But of course, it's not in our grasp. It is, it's Carrie, isn't it? Basically. Yeah. And we have to, we have to wait and see. She is like, you know, the new goddess of bad decisions.
Wait, what's terrible? But it's true, Chris, as you were saying, that so much of this is about the politics of it. Like, they had to do something. The unfortunate thing is the fact that they do now feel the need to kind of engage in these theatrics at all times. Because you just think if the government was able to just say, for all intents and purposes, it's over. We've done as much as we possibly could do. You know, they'd be written up as not only reckless, but, you know, kind of almost quasi-genocidal in their sort of intent, such as it is that we've sort of crossed that line towards safety, in inverted commas, just being the sort of guiding principle at this point. Yeah. I mean, is it just that this is going to have to sort of wear out? You know, it'll be like another 6 months. People will realise that, you know, we've got a very heavily vaccinated population. They're not seeing their loved ones dropping like flies. And then the government will feel comfortable kind of saying, actually, this is over now. Is it just going to take a little bit longer before they can be honest with people?
To be honest, I don't want to, you know, carry water for the government, but I think really they were getting pretty close to that point and had been since July. You know, and all this while we've had bloody Independent Sage and a few of these people very vocal. And what happens is we need to put masks on kids and we need to vaccinate 5-year-olds and blah, 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 blah. And it's been incessant. Every time the cases go up, it gets more and more hysterical. But the government's ignored all that kind of stuff. They've always said there was a plan B. They always said that this was irreversible if there wasn't some big variant. It's not like they've suddenly pulled this out and there's an excuse to suddenly mask us up again. It's pretty obvious to me Boris Johnson doesn't want to bring any of this stuff in. Pretty obvious that the Sajid Javid didn't want to bring in vaccine passports, and he didn't. But they did say that, you know, we're not completely out of the woods. There's always a chance of something bad happening. And I think this is as legitimate a kind of a scenario for being potentially quite bad as you're likely to see. And even so, they've only made us wear masks on trains and shops. So I don't think they're itching at all to be doing a lot more on this. And yes, I think if we can kind of weather this storm, I think we probably will, then I think it's pretty plain sailing.
I mean, the theatricality of it is slightly ridiculous, though.
Oh, of course,
I mean,
you know,
we're talking about
a
strain that they think is, you know, potentially more transmissible than Delta.
But we're going to beat it with masks in shops.
With masks in shops.
Not in pubs or anywhere else.
Like Delta, you know, overwhelmed the Australian police state, but this mask or whatever. But it is so unfortunate. I mean, one thing that might be worth picking up on is the fact that it's actually called the Omicron variant.
Yes.
Because originally it was called the new variant. I'm not sure if anyone remembered this.
Which is confusing.
2 days.
I can see that. So it's obviously it should be Z, right?
Exactly. So the next letter in the alphabet, of course, was Z or Xi in the Chinese.
Yeah.
But for whatever reason, they haven't confirmed. The World Health Organization.
They said that it's a very common surname.
Oh, they actually
came out. Yeah, they came out and said it.
Oh, common turnip. So it's not just to defend the leader of the CCP.
Oh, that right? Never crossed my mind. It's a very common surname, particularly.
They should have called it the Winnie the Pooh variant.
They wouldn't dare do that, of course. But that was quite a fascinating sort of. I think the thing that's quite depressing about this is that everything feels so nostalgic. You know, we had that press conference on Friday night. You know, we refused to rule anything out.
WHO said no travel bans.
WHO said no travel bans. Then did something which was kind of a sop to the CCP. That was nice to see again. You had various members of the media taking it in turns to demand martial law at the immediate opportunity. You just feel like we are stuck in this doom loop.
Well, the trouble is, we have created in the last 18 months, understandably, but a lot of bad incentives, haven't we? You know, there are bad incentives for certain scientific advisors and doctors and journalists, you know, to keep us on high alert because it elevates their status. Mm. There are certain people who've made their career out of this and they don't like the idea that it might just be over, you know, that it was a flash in the pan. I mean, I totally understand that. You know, we all have that kind of, I think there's another seriousness in this, guys, you know. What do you mean? He dies at the end. You can't, you know, what are you going to do? You can have this sort of a few straight-to-video versions or whatever, the prequel. But I think that's a lot of what's happened. I really do. You know, I think there's an awful lot of people who, you know, the Fauci's and the Witties, but, you know, not anything particularly against Witty, but that kind of people, the Neil Ferguson, obviously, who's had decades of being an absolute laughing stock, you know, constantly like sounding the alarm like some ludicrous medieval monk from the top of a tower every time he sees a swine flu heading across the ocean, you know, and finally he's got his day in the sun and he doesn't want it to be over, you know. That's just human nature. I personally think Boris's approach to this is probably fairly close to the best you could have, which is to not be very strongly one way or the other. It's his usual fudging, isn't it? And that's probably is the best that you can hope for. I don't think any prime minister is going to stand up and go, this is over. It's over. Okay, get back to work, get back to normal. It's over. You've been vaccinated. You've had your fun. Now get back to work. Nobody can dare do that. So the thing to do is talk about other things and hope that the virus just moves on. Mm.
Are you looking for the perfect gift for the pro-freedom, anti-woke person in your life? Then look no further than the Spiked Shop. You can now get your favourite Spiked slogan on a t-shirt, hoodie, tote bag or mug, including ban nothing, question everything, love Europe, hate the EU and cancel culture. Plus, if you're a Spiked supporter, you can get a 15% discount off of everything. Just go to spiked-online.com/shop to browse our items and make your purchases. That's spiked-online.com/shop. So we should move on to our second topic, which is hooked off of an article that you wrote, Simon, for us, your column, about America losing its mind, America coming apart, America seeming to be so plunged into kind of like one form of hysteria after another, it feels like at the moment. I wish you could you just tell us a little bit about kind of what spurred you to write that piece and what you think is going so horribly wrong over there at the
it's
moment.
It's been a growing sort of sense that I've had of alarm, really, it could easily be the media filters that I expose myself to, but at least since not just the dawn of Trump, but really the attempts to undermine and delegitimize Trump and the measures taken and the lengths gone to in order to get rid of him, you know. But I don't know whether that kind of empowered. I know I feel a little bit hesitant to use words like empowered because I always get angry when people go, oh, Brexit empowered or emboldened racist. You know, it's a way of thinking about things that usually exposes your own biases and prejudices. But I think it's exposed a kind of, we've been talking for a long time, I know, about identity politics and the sort of victimhood mania that's kind of driving a lot of that kind of stuff. But it just seems to be legitimized to an extraordinary extent. What used to be like campus politics, what used to be student protests in the 60s, 70s, 80s, you know, young people have always gone crazy, dyed their hair pink and shouted down with everything. But it just seems to be like really gripping the whole nation now and driving the agenda. And they've just really lost the plot, I think. And all that kind of stuff just seems to be, I mean, it would be fine if it was just a bit of eccentric icing on an otherwise tasty cake. But actually, America is in a lot of trouble. It's got huge drug dependency problems. Deaths of despair are off the scale. You know, their prison population is spiraling constantly. And they have something that I think is quite legitimately referred to as the prison industrial complex. They think of the prisons in very much the same terms as the military industrial congressional complex, you know, laws being passed in order to feed the arms manufacturers. And the same thing is happening with the prisons. And Black Lives Matter has got under the skin now of a huge swathe of very active people. And it doesn't have to be everyone, but this is one of the things that we all know now, right? There's this kind of figure that's thrown around. I dare say it could be plus or minus a couple of percents, but they say like 3.5% of the population have to be really activated for things to change. That's all you need. All you need is a really loud, urgent and crazed small percentage. And America seems to be getting driven by that to a large extent now and just seems to be rejecting all the things. It was a creation of the Enlightenment. It was the absolute, you know, it was the jewel in the crown of the Enlightenment. You know, it's the convention and the Bill of Rights and all the rest of it. You know, they were fantastically well organized and hard won and well thought through constitutional grounds on which to build a nation. And a lot of it is just being dismantled now in order to satisfy pressure groups who haven't really thought through what might happen.
I mean, one thing that it feels like the kind of current predicament America is in really came to the fore in recent weeks was the Kyle Rittenhouse trial, which I know you wrote about, I wrote about as well, because it was so striking how you basically have a sort of liberal establishment, if we want to call it that, who are so devoted to the narrative that the facts don't dent it whatsoever. So I know a lot of people in Britain won't necessarily been following this story as closely as anyone else, but essentially you had this kid in the summer last year in Kenosha in Wisconsin, who whilst there were sort of riots, Black Lives Matter riots effectively ripping through the city, place where his dad and his family lived, he decides, and several other people show up with this rifle to protect businesses and to offer support to people because the police are completely withdrawn. And he ends up shooting three people, killing two of them. This was presented instantly as he was essentially, in the words of one Democratic congresswoman, a white supremacist domestic terrorist who had crossed state lines to take aim
at the very protesters. Least a vigilante, which they use that term in to imply lynching and that kind of mentality.
And the narrative was so cast that this was just another kind of symptom of America's white supremacy, that you had even like quite prominent liberal commentators admitting over the course of that trial that they didn't realise that he fired only in self-defense, that they didn't realize that all of his victims were white, realize any of these details whatsoever. And that felt like a kind of line was crossed there, where it's just everything is about burnishing this narrative. The facts don't make any difference. People doubled down in the wake of that verdict. And then you had from the top, Joe Biden say that this verdict troubled him. So it just feels like, as you say, all of these kind of principles, it's just been completely dashed, it feels like. Do you think the Rittenhouse thing was kind of significant?
No, I absolutely do, although it wasn't the first for me by any means. I think if I had to identify one incident, a very similar incident, it was the Covington High School thing, where the young kid was snapped, photographed sort of apparently smirking into the face of what is known as an elder, which is an old man, basically, who happens to be of a Native American heritage. And that story, again, was totally spun and controlled the narrative, and it was completely in defiance of obvious, unambiguous video evidence about what the sequence of events were, which completely exonerated this kid who was, you know, he was wearing a MAGA hat, and that was enough, of course, to damn him in the eyes of these.
But he got an enormous amount of money, didn't he?
The
other thing about America is they have a crazy legal system where you get billions of dollars.
Carl Rittenhouse
presumably will.
Well, it's a very good question. He says he has no intention of doing so, but if he did change his mind, I mean, there are millions to be had. And as you say, people double down on it even after the verdict. It's extraordinary, and saying it wouldn't have happened if he'd been black. We all know what would have happened. I mean, apart from the fact that, you know, how many of the other facts do you want to change? If he's black, do the victims remain white or whatever? But there is a guy who was literally exonerated on the same day, who was black, who had shot police officers who broke in to his flat during a raid, and he had fired at them, and he was still allowed to claim self-defense. I mean, so it's and that case, of course, was completely ignored. Yeah. And I think it's important to emphasize when you use the word liberal, because I use it too about the American media, because it's their word and how they use it. It doesn't mean anything like it means here. You know, it has nothing to do with John Stuart Mill, you know, or even Vince Cable, exactly. Or Nick Clegg. It is essentially a sort of almost like a left-wing brainworm, you know, liberal for them, and it is becoming a really serious issue. You know, they just don't seem to be able to restore balance and or any degree of integrity. And if they lose, if you've got papers like the New York Times and the Washington Post who are promulgating this absolute nonsense, you know, deliberately obscuring and excluding facts from their accounts, America is in very, very serious trouble, because nobody trusts anybody else's version of events. And when that happens, I mean, it's a hard country to keep tied together anyway. You know, it's massive. It's a United States. You know, it's conceivably a plural already to begin with. If it becomes disunited, then I don't know. I mean, obviously, you know, China rubbing its hands together in glee, in exactly the same way that I know a lot of people said Putin was when he saw Brexit, you know, dissolving the European Union. But maybe I'm seeing it from the other side now. I don't know, but I can't help thinking that if it were a PSYOP, then if the KGB was still active, you could struggle to imagine them having any better results than the ones that seem to be going on at the moment.
I mean, it's often said, Chris, that, you know, we're sort of downstream from America, really, on a lot of these issues, but surely we can't get as mad as America has in recent years. Or do you think a lot of this stuff that Simon's been talking about, the identity politics, the general sort of hysteria, is sort of heading this way?
It's hard to believe it happening here, isn't it? But people always say that. It can't happen here. I mean, everything else has happened here.
Yep.
You know, I mean, all the loony nanny state stuff from California has happened here, more or less, or is on its way. You know, go to Sussex University or Goldstones or whatever, you'll find the same idiotic educational ideas knocking around. So I don't see why not. It's a great shame. It's just another reason, you know, I'm banging on this. Banging on about this more and more these days, but yeah, I think Western civilization is finished. And you know, the saddest thing for me about America going completely balmy is it's one of a fairly small number of countries on my list that I could emigrate to, and I can't go there now because they've gone nuts. I don't fancy the sound of Canada. There has to be English speaking.
You don't think
honest.
You'd be writing like Texas?
Texas
or something,
is supposed to be the one.
Well,
that's
the thing about America.
But it's probably got
place.
Another 5 years of
Nevada,
Texas.
Nevada, Texas, Arizona, maybe I could get
maybe
along
Wisconsin
with for a bit.
Exactly. You know what you can get away with.
I'm thinking Gibraltar. I think that's a good bet. It has. I need sunshine. I need English language.
Well, I had a very agreeable weekend in Seville recently. It gets a bit hot in the height of summer. I think you probably want to go up to the north of Portugal.
You don't like it hot, do you? See, I like
not
it
really
very hot,
but if you like it very hot, then Seville's
your
place.
There. A lot of gambling companies in Gibraltar. I don't know. There's not many places to flee to, is there? Even if you can get your PCR test.
Or South Africa.
Maybe give it a few weeks before.
I don't know. I think we're just doomed. I'm just going to see it out here in Blighty, I think.
The thing was, I think about this sometimes. I don't know if we've thought about this before, Spengler, Decline of the West. I mean, this book was published just on the eve of the First World War and was seen as being prophetic of that. But essentially it said it's over then. That was 100 years ago, you know. We've been running on fumes, essentially, for quite a long time. The First World War was the West committing suicide. The Second World War was the sort of second the other shoe dropping on that same. There's been no reason. Everything that's happened since then of any excitement has either been a technological breakthrough or youth culture. You know, things like Elvis and the Beatles have been fantastic, but that's obviously nothing compared to like the Roman Empire type stuff, is it? You know, so there's obviously, you know, there's a kind of, you know, the corpse is taking some time to go through full rigor mortis, but it's been over for some time.
Yeah,
according to people
who
think about these things, you know.
But we can still laugh along the way, which is why we should get onto our last topic, which is Barry Humphries basically taking the media for fools, which was this fascinating thing over the weekend. So Barry Humphries, obviously of Dame Edna and Sir Les Paterson fame, great Australian comic, who was on the This Morning Sofa on Friday with Dermot O'Leary and Alison Hammond, I believe, who was sitting in for the usual Philip Schofield and Holly Willoughby. And at one point, just apropos of nothing, turns around and congratulates Dermot O'Leary on coming out of the closet. and it's absolutely brilliant, very simple, but very effective, very effective joke. Brilliant on its own terms, but also striking for the response, Simon, just because of the fact that the Huffington Post, I think even various quite prominent journalists seem to say, if you know, the most they could say about it was, if this is intentional, this is funny. But they kind of naturally assumed that he just
that was Jeremy
mistake.
Vine, wasn't it? If this this is intentional, you're like, what do you mean if? I mean, it's actually a joke format.
I mean, his brother's a
before.
Comedian. You think he would know the ropes, roughly speaking.
Although he wouldn't do that one, interestingly, Tim.
But what did you make of all of this?
Well, I thought the joke was done brilliantly. And of course, I mean, it's not even quite a joke, is it? It's teasing. It's a creation of a very awkward scene, you know, which, to be fair, I think the presenters handled very well. You know, Dermot Leary just kind of crumples with embarrassment about the whole thing. Alison Hammond is shrieking with laughter. I don't know too much about it, but she seems very likable. Somebody shared an interview she did with Harrison Ford and Ryan Gosling, I think, or something that, for the Blade Runner, and they are both ended up creased up in laughter. She seems like a very funny, genuinely happy,
famously difficult man to interview.
Apparently he really went for her. So no, I mean, he does it brilliantly, Humphries, and it is puncturing the pomposity of Schofield coming out. Of course, is what is the target, really? Not Dermot O'Leary. Dermot O'Leary. That's the beauty of the joke. Dermot O'Leary can't kind of defend himself because he's not actually the butt of the joke, even though he's sat there. He's being projected onto. I don't even know if the Huffington Post watched it. I don't know if they just picked it up offline. I mean, it just tells you a great deal, I think, about the piss poor, you know, journalism that passes on these online sort of enterprises sometimes. And it felt to me like that, but I mean, I could be reading too much into it, but it is a fact that HuffPost and the Indie and so on went for Humphries a couple of years ago because he did kind of wade into the trans thing. I suppose because people thought, oh, he'll be pro-trans because he's been dressing up as a woman all this time. And he's like, what? No, you know, sex, biological sex is real, blah, blah, blah. And he was, you know, like all those other old timers, you know, like John Cleese and so on, these people who've, you know, spent a lifetime, you know, mocking absurdity and sort of had enough about the absurdity actually coming, you know, backwash into real life. And I think they went for him as a result. I think they were delighted, as again, I may be projecting, but I think they were absolutely delighted that this old man had made a fool of himself and demonstrated that his opinions were no longer of any value or worth, and he could be safely ignored because he couldn't even tell the difference between Philip Schofield and Dermot O'Leary, you know. And in fact, he was absolutely round the back of them laughing at them, you know. So it was really delightful and enjoyable. But I suppose it's a storm in a teacup, but these things mount up, don't they? Do you know what I mean? It's an incremental sense that these people have lost touch with reality, that they have no idea, and that they sit in judgment very happily and are very, very quick to dismiss.
No sense of humour.
No, absolutely. Yeah. As I said in the article, I think wokeness arguably is what rushes in when the sense of humour departs. You know, that's what will rush in to fill the hole.
And just on that point, do you think that because of this sort of woke climate that it's going to be difficult to have another kind of Barry Humphreys or whatever, partly because they don't get it, but also because you're just not really allowed to even implicitly poke fun at the kind of aura around Philip Schofield after he made his valiant
another Barry Humphreys or another Dame Edna. It's probably like as unthinkable as another Beatles or another Led Zeppelin. Mm. These things are, they come out of a certain culture, you know. Humphreys came out of a certain period in Australian national life, you know, and a certain kind of cultural cringe, you know, that Clive James also emerged from and talked about, you know, and the same way that John Cleese emerged from a very repressed lower middle class household in Western Supermare of the kind that probably doesn't exist anymore. People's humour does like often reflect early experiences and a certain kind of elitism that he was capable of enjoying, you know, at the time. Things will move on. I don't think there will be another Dame Edna, no. But, I mean, that would be kind of – I don't know what that would look like exactly. You could say that Partridge was a worthy heir for the time that he was on, and maybe there'll be another one that will come along and be another exposure of whatever toe-curling conceivable archetypes, you know, dominating our screen now. But Dame Edna now wouldn't make any sense because she was a kind of, as well as lampooning the stars that she was on the sofa with or whatever, she was also lampooning a certain kind of brash, oblivious, unself-aware Australian housewife, you know, that wouldn't exist anymore either. You know, her own mother, essentially, Humphreys, you know, said, and various aunts that used to come over with their bingo wings, as he referred to them, you know. He was an absolute, well, he remains. I've booked tickets to go and see him next May. He's 87 and he's on tour as himself. I think it'll be a fairly low-key evening by comparison with some of the great sort of multi-character extravaganzas of the past, but a hell of a victory lap.
But the obvious target is the woke themselves, right, for satire. I mean, if you look at the target of Partridge, it was a certain kind of middle-aged man or TV presenter. If you look at the target of Dame Edna, it was, you know, a middle-aged Australian housewife. The obvious target for satire now is the woke. Some people are kind of doing it a bit.
Well, Andrew Doyle is the one.
I mean, there's nothing really stopping comedians from attacking these people or satirizing these people. Same as there isn't really anything stopping Hollywood producers going out there and doing a good old-fashioned 1980s action film or whatever, with a bit of sexism thrown in if they feel like doing it. And I think they probably will, because as far as I can tell, Hollywood's really doing very badly these days, not just because of COVID, because they're making all these high-minded films that nobody wants to watch. And at the end of the day, capitalism will prevail, I think, in this.
Cannibalism.
Capitalism.
Capitalism. Or sorry, cannibalism.
Same thing as well.
Either way, make a good film.
Yeah. The hills have eyes.
And so, you know, unless there's actual legal restraints on satire, and I know there are kind of, you know, hate speech stuff at the very extreme end, but generally speaking, we still have freedom of artistic expression. I think that just the fact that there's a very small audience for, you know, woke comedy, for example.
Yeah.
Where people...
there's a huge audience. I mean, Hollywood have gone all in on the CGI, the Marvel Cinematic Universe and Star Wars. And I think they've absolutely had a bellyful of it now, you know. And that, it's not woke technically. Some people say that's kind of fascism, really, in fancy dress, you know, the idea that a strong man can settle all these arguments.
Marlon would say it's libertarian.
Right.
He's got a whole hypothesis about how the entire Marvel Universe is libertarian.
But it is, I suppose, sort of woke in the sense that it presents a lot of women with upper body strength equivalent to, you know, to Muhammad Ali or whatever. And there's a kind of a denial, I suppose, of some biological realities there.
But maybe that's not too bad.
No, know? It's okay. It's just joyful fantasy. That's fine. But there is something pleasing also about seeing, you know, Dirty Harry, isn't there? That kind of, you know,
very much.
I think we'd all like to see that come back.
That's why people are still watching that kind of, those kind of films and still listening to, you know, the Beatles and the decent stuff. And, the Beatles won't come back.
You know, Camille Paglia has a she gave a talk about how the Rolling Stones, you know, just has testicles, that music. It has bollocks, you know, and it swings and it kicks and it's got testosterone in its in its DNA. And you don't hear that so much in music now. She's not an old man. She's, you know, she's a Californian lesbian, you know, and so she should be listened to on this. I absolutely confer authority on her. And if she was to withdraw those comments, I would go quietly. But I don't know quite what it is. But I do think, I mean, my son is, you know, I was talking about this recently, is into electric guitar. And that's all the stuff he listens to. It's like, you know, Guns N' Roses and stuff. And I think it's going to come back. I cannot see that we can endlessly just keep draining all the problematic sexuality and instinct for violence out of public life. well, we'll either come back or we'll just stop breeding altogether. You know, those are the two options.
Well, the difference is with the music, I think there's probably been enough songs written really for anybody, you know. Yeah. So we've got the rest. Do we need more songs really? There's so much, you know, every art form has its peaks and troughs and, and they do the stuff and it's right, that's enough of Renaissance paintings. We don't need any more. We'll just enjoy that. With films, it's different. They need to keep releasing new films. Mm-hmm. Comedians need to keep producing new material.
Yeah.
Unless we're all going to stay at home watching Bill Hicks and Eddie Murphy, then the art form has to get bums on seats, right? Not even progress. Just has to get bums on seats.
That's true of rock music as well, though, surely.
Not really, because no one cares whether there's never going to be another rock band, because we got the records.
I want to go and see live rock, and it's good if it's a band playing their own songs. I mean, if Guns N' Roses were immortal, I'd be happy with that, but they're not. They get annoyed,
I'm seeing them next year.
Yeah.
I think it'd be probably tribute bands, to be honest. I think old man time. Yeah. I think all the good songs have been written.
Well, on that suitably downbeat note, Chris, Simon, thank you very much.
You're absolutely welcome.
You've been listening to Last Orders. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Please do take a moment to leave us a rating and a review. And if you'd like to support the show, why not become a Spiked supporter? Just go to spiked-online.com/supporters to sign up. That's spiked-online.com/supporters.